From the City of Angels off the Pacific Ocean, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation around the world. I'm George Norrie, and welcome to Coast AM, the last hour of the program tonight, 2012 and crop formations. So get ready for that. But here's what's happening. Well, all the way from Miami to Maine, Savannah to Seattle, America is caught up in an icy grip that one of the UN's top global warming proponents says could mark the beginning of a mini ice age. Oranges are freezing. Millions of tropical fish are dying in Florida. And it could be just the beginning of a decades-long deep freeze, according to a professor, one of the world's leading climate modelers. He says that the cold snap Americans have been suffering through is only the beginning. He says we're in for 30 years of cooler temperatures, a mini ice age, as he calls it, basing his theory on an analysis of natural cycles and water temperatures in the world's ocean. But who has been saying this on this program for a number of years? It's Robert Felix, not by fire, but by ice. Robert, this is an incredible story.
Oh, it is. I agree that, you know, you're right. I've been saying this for years, and you've been helping me say it, and I thank you. But I'm afraid that this little ice age is beginning at this time. And one of the things that I've said is, as you know, is that that I think the warmer oceans were driven by underwater volcanoes, which leads to more moisture rising into the sky. And that's exactly what this scientist that you're talking about, that you're mentioned, is talking about, is that he has discovered that the ocean warming begins at 3,000 feet down, which is something I've been saying for more than 10 years.
Absolutely. And you're not a meteorologist. You're not a geologist like Birkeland is. He's going to join us in a second. You just, how did you know this?
Oh, I just, I spent 8.5 years full-time researching it. And you know, it just seemed, as you get into the research, it just seems logical. I mean, how in the world could humans heat the oceans 3,000 feet down before they heat the surface? So I've been saying, and I'm thinking someday that will be my contribution. I mean, many other people have said that we could have an ice age, but I haven't heard of other people talking about underwater volcanoes being the driver. So I think someday that may prove to be one of my big contributions.
I think so, too. Robert's website will be on our Twitter feed at coasttocoastam.com. A very curious object is about to fly past Earth only 80,000 miles away, catalogued as a 10-meter-class asteroid, 2010 AL30, that's what it's called, has an orbital period of almost exactly 1 year. But this raises the possibility that it might not be a natural object, perhaps a piece of some spacecraft from our own planet. At closest approach on January 13th, 2010 AL30 will glow like a 14th magnitude star. Seismologists have long been predicting that the big one for California is in the future, but on January 9th, a magnitude 6.5 earthquake struck off the coast of Northern California. The quake caused only minor damage, but is a sign of increasing instability in the area. However, some seismologists think that the gigantic earthquake may shake the ground one day in Seattle instead. Jim Birkeland and Cal Orry were on our predictions program around the New Year's Eve, New Year's Day period. They both predicted a major earthquake for Northern California sometime this year. Jim, did you expect it to be this fast?
Well, I wasn't surprised. Cal was right on the money with it. And she won our $100 bet as to whether Northern or Southern California would get the next six. And I was just a tenth or two off with the Mexicali quake. So I have to say more power to her. But this one was, you know, that was just major damage. You're saying minor damage. There's at least about $14 million damage so far just in Eureka. And a lot of homes, they showed pictures of them, homes knocked off their foundations and a lot of shelf damage and the glass breakage and so forth. So it was fairly impressive, and it was felt clear down in Reno.
Jim, what I found to be fascinating about this is when you were on the anniversary program with me on Sunday, you talked about the seals that were disappearing from the San Francisco Bay Area. Yeah. They went to Oregon. They knew this, didn't they?
I am convinced. Now, these are sea lions. And they arrived in San Francisco Bay in September of 89, just before the big quake. And then they fled just after 20 years, just before this next fairly large quake here off the coast.
I have also heard that during this period, pets at home were doing all kinds of bizarre things around the house, and people have been documenting that.
So I've seen many skunks smashed along the road because animals just lose their normal caution. We had, so look at this, if people just pay attention, just before the World Series quake, we had baby whales wash up at Ocean Beach, San Francisco, and at Santa Cruz alive. That's never happened before or since.
Jeez, what a measuring tool. What a predictor.
Yeah.
Jim,
yeah.
What's your website? And you have a newsletter, right?
Yes. And I'm working on the February issue right now, and January was quite a success. That 7.2 in the Solomons was in the middle of the window right after the eclipse of the moon.
Scissorgyjob.com is your website.
Correct. If they want to send the listeners a self-addressed stamped envelope, I'll send them a sample copy of my newsletter, and that's Jim Berkland, P.O. Box 1926. That was 4 years before I was born. And it's a little town of Glen Ellen, California, 95442. And I'm back here with my wife. I'd been here away for 30 years, and she joined me here, and we're really happy and never will lose again.
Well, super, Jim. Thank you. So here we have two experts here, Robert Felix, who has been predicting ice ages on this program for 7 years, and now it looks like he's being backed up by a major climatologist. And now Jim Berkland, who has been talking about earthquakes for years, predicting them with pretty good accuracy. And here we are again with another hit for Jim Berkland. The top U.S. consumer product regulator is warning Asian manufacturers not to substitute other toxic substances for lead in children's items. A message that follows the launch of a government investigation into Chinese-made jewelry now that lab tests showed was laden with heavy metal, the cadmium. Now, overexposure to cadmium is very toxic to humans. MRSA, the bacterial infection, is mainly spread by patients moving between hospitals, according to Dutch researchers. The authors have called for more screening of people who are repeatedly admitted to different hospitals to try to break this transmission cycle. They said this would eventually help to eradicate MRSA. MRSA is a potentially lethal bug, which is difficult to fight because it has developed resistance to some antibiotics. Lounging in front of the television not only eats up hours in your day, but may also shorten your life, according to a new study. The study, which looked at the connection between watching TV and death for 8,800 Australian adults, found that each hour of TV viewing was associated with an 11% increased risk of death from any cause and an 18% increased risk of death from cardiovascular disease. These findings held true even after the researchers took into account other factors that could raise the risk of dying, such as age, gender, waist circumference, and exercise habits. That means listen to the radio instead of television. Miep Geis, the last surviving member of the group who helped protect Anne Frank and her family from the Nazis, has died in the Netherlands, aged 100. She and other employees of Anne Frank's father, Otto, supplied food to the family as they hid in a secret annex above the business premises in Amsterdam. Anne's diary of their life in hiding, which ended in betrayal, is one of the most famous records of the Holocaust. Geis died in a nursing home after suffering a fall at Christmas. Vital signs are improving for the American automakers. That's good news. General Motors may reopen some shuttered factories because it can't produce four of its vehicles fast enough to meet demand. Chrysler is set to hire more engineers and product development workers. Now, while both companies still depend on our help, our taxpayer help, the moves are signs of increased confidence that the U.S. auto market bottomed out last year, I hope, and will improve in 2010, even without a jolt from a cash for clunkers style program. In a moment, Sean Carroll joins us as we talk from eternity to here, the quest for the ultimate theory of time. And welcome back to Coast, I'm George Norrie. I'm going to predict on this program right now that our guest that's coming right up is going to be one of the giants in the field, Sean Carroll, Senior Research Associate and physics at the California Institute of Technology. His research involves theoretical physics and astrophysics, focusing on issues of cosmology, field theory, and gravitation. His current research involves models of dark matter and dark energy and modifications of Einstein's general relativity, the physics of inflationary cosmology, and the origin of time asymmetry. He has received research grants from NASA, the Department of Energy, and the National Science Foundation, as well as fellowships from the Sloan and Packard Foundations. Here he is, complete show on Coast to Coast AM. Hello, Sean. How are you?
Great. How are you, George?
Good to have you. Good. Not only a good job from eternity to here, but you made it simple for a lot of people to understand. I think that's so important.
Well, I thought it was a great topic to do that with because, on the one hand, everyone experiences time every day. But on the other hand, deep down in the physics of it, there's a lot of mysteries yet to be explained. So it was a good introduction, a good way to introduce a lot of crazy ideas.
I seem to live by time, Sean. I look at the watch all the time. I'm looking at digital clocks when I'm in the studio. It's around me all the time. But what's your perception of time?
Well, I think that's exactly right. I mean, we all move through time. We experience it every day. We use our watches to be in the right place. So we can use time very, very well. But the mysteries about it go all the way back to St. Augustine, who said something that is absolutely still true today, namely, roughly speaking, if you need to me to use time, I can do it. But if you ask me what it means, I can't tell you. And that still remains true today. If you say, okay, it's something lasts an hour, what does that mean? If I say that I'm flowing through time, yesterday I remember, but I don't remember tomorrow, why is that true? Physicists know a lot about how it works, but they're missing some of the ultimate reasons why.
And unless you're watching a Twilight Zone show, you can't stop time, can you? It just keeps moving on.
You can't stop time. Thanks to Einstein, you can play with it a little bit. You can speed it up and slow it down compared to other people, either by moving very fast, close to the speed of light, or by sitting inside a very strong gravitational field. But stopping it is something you can't do. As far as you're concerned, time will always go forward 1 second per second.
Now, is time travel truly going to be possible? And I've had some physicists on, Sean, who have said, we're already traveling in the future. We're doing it by these little nanoseconds. You know what? That doesn't excite me. I want to know that I can get in a time machine one day and zoom into the future or go back to the past. Can I do that one day?
Well, those two things are very different, zooming into the future and going back to the past. Zooming into the future, if Isaac Newton had been right about everything, would also be impossible. We just have to wait. It's going to be 1 year per year, nothing you can do about it. When Einstein comes along, he gives us a way that we can move into the future. And it's simply that if you zoom off in a rocket ship close to the speed of light and you come back, the total amount of time you will have experienced is much less than the time experienced by the people who remain back here on Earth. So essentially, you've traveled in the future. You've experienced a week. The people back here on Earth have experienced however long you want, weeks, months, years, centuries. All you have to do is build a rocket ship that can go close to the speed of light, but to a fundamental physicist, that's just an engineering problem.
Sean, were there any holes in Einstein's theories of time and space? Did he make any mistakes?
Einstein made plenty of mistakes because he was a prolific guy. He wrote a lot of papers. He had a lot of ideas. But the basic ideas of relativity, as we now understand it, are still our best ideas about space and time. We have not actually found any part of special relativity or general relativity, Einstein's two great theories, that anyone would say is certainly wrong according to the experimental data. But we're trying, you know, we're always trying to do better. We're always trying to develop theories and test them against Einstein's. I propose theories myself that differ in minor ways from Einstein's theory of relativity, and so far he's the winner, to no one's surprise. But we still think that Einstein can't have the final word because there's lurking in the background quantum mechanics. There's the equally successful theory of the microscopic world. And Einstein's theory of general relativity, his theory of space and time and curvature and black holes, is incompatible with quantum mechanics. They can't both be right. And the smart money is that it's Einstein's theory that is eventually going to yield and be part of something bigger. We're just not yet sure what.
This discussion of time, when you talk about time, you'll also have to talk about the universe. And then the new talk, Sean, is the multiverses. Are there more than just one? Or are we part of a larger universe that we just can't even imagine?
Yeah, and I think this is another reason why I thought that the topics of my book made a great discussion, because you go from things that happen in your kitchen, where time moves in one direction. You can take an egg and turn it into an omelet, but you can't turn the omelet back into an egg. And that highlights the arrow of time, the fact that time has a direction. And this was not explained by Einstein. This was actually explained by a guy who came before Einstein, Ludwig Boltzmann, an Austrian physicist in the 19th century. But Boltzmann's understanding of the arrow of time, the fact that entropy increases, you know, entropy is this way we have of measuring the disorderliness of the universe. Things go from being neat and stacked in piles to being disorderly and messy and scattered all around the place. So Boltzmann explained that in physics terms with equations and quantitatively and so forth. But nevertheless, there's a missing piece to that explanation. And that missing piece is, why was the universe ever orderly, low entropy to begin with? And that's an unanswered question even today. It takes us all the way back to the Big Bang and what happened at the very earliest moments of the history of our observable universe. And my guess, which may or may not be right, it's right now very speculative and hypothetical, is that the reason why our early universe was so orderly is the same reason why the egg in our kitchen was so orderly. It's because the egg didn't pop out of existence all by itself. It came out of a chicken. And likewise, I'm suggesting that the universe that we observe is not all by itself. It comes out of a larger multiverse. And understanding how those things are connected can help us understand why what we observe in the universe started in such a low entropy, orderly state, all wound up and ready for the universe to evolve as it has been for the last 14 billion years.
Sean, are you saying that the Big Bang did not occur the way most physicists tell us?
I think that most physicists are a little sloppy. You know, when you talk to most physicists, they're trying to get across the idea that the Big Bang is something special. And again, if you believed Einstein's theory of general relativity, which is our best theory yet for space and time, it would say that something happened at the Big Bang, but we don't know what. It's basically the equations give out. The general relativity itself says, I just don't know what happens here. I'm throwing up my arms. Something's got to give. But that's okay, because we know that we think that general relativity is not right. Fundamentally, it needs to be improved by marrying it to quantum mechanics. So some scientists try to shortcut all of this careful explanation by saying that the Big Bang is the absolute beginning of space and time, and before the Big Bang is a nonsensical notion. It's like saying what's north of the North Pole. That's just a little bit too sloppy, I think, because really what we should be saying is the Big Bang is not the beginning of the universe, it's the end of our knowledge of the universe. It could be that the Big Bang is the beginning, or it could be there was something before that. It's our job to sort of think carefully about what all the possibilities are and which do a better job of helping us understand the features of the universe that we see.
Do you think science will ever, ever show us or teach us who we are and why we're here and how this happened?
Well, it depends on what answers to those questions would satisfy you. Science, I think, will be part of answering those questions. Science is going to help us understand the world in which we live, and we're part of that world. So science is going to help us put ourselves in perspective. But science won't ever tell you, you know, how to act right or wrong in the world, or what makes a painting beautiful, or something like that. There's still a lot left for we human beings to work out and establish on our own.
As they talk about dark matter and dark energy making up most of the universe, in terms of our knowledge, Sean, what percent would you say we're at in terms of knowing things in the universe? Just a small percent?
Well, something amazing happened in 1998. You can really pinpoint it, which is a nice thing, which is in 1998, we put together an inventory of what the universe is made of. At least if you count not particles or anything like that, but you slice up the universe in terms of energy, how much energy is there in the universe, we have very good reason to believe that we know the major constituents of the universe. And I can explain this in great detail.
Let's go through that when we come right back. We're going to take this quick break. Our special guest tonight, Sean Carroll, physicist. His latest work, From Eternity to Here, The Quest for the Ultimate Theory of Time. And that's our mission tonight on Coast to Coast AM. If you are a Streamlink member, well, of course, tomorrow night will be our chat, 8 p.m. Pacific time. Just go hook yourself in, and I'll be there, and we'll chat away. And a lot of personal questions are asked during these chats, but I make myself available to you once a month, so we will do that tomorrow, 8 p.m. Pacific time, at coasttocoastam.com for Streamlink members. And welcome back to Coast to Coast. I'm George Norrie. We're with physicist Sean Carroll from Eternity to Here. Sean, you were telling us about this 1988 science, putting together an inventory of what the universe is. Go ahead.
That's right. If you measure the universe by energy, the humbling fact is that stuff like us, atoms and molecules and stars and gas and planets and so forth, is only 4% of the universe. And we sort of had a hint of that for a long time, and that sort of became more and more clear. There's also this stuff called dark matter, which was hinted at for a long time and became very believable in the 1980s and is now more or less beyond reasonable doubt, but that's only 23% of the universe. So in 1998, we figured out what the other 73% of the universe is, and that's this stuff called dark energy. This, not even a particle, not even some sort of thing you could lay your hands on. It's just the energy of empty space. If you have nothing at all, how much energy does it have? Well, Einstein said even empty space can carry energy, and everyone thought that that was an interesting hypothetical speculation but wouldn't apply to the real world. In 1998, we saw its effects. That energy of empty space is pushing apart distant galaxies, and they're actually accelerating away from us. You'd expect that our gravitational pull would pull on the galaxies and their gravitational pull would pull on us, and we would eventually begin to come together. But in fact, they're moving away from us faster and faster. So that implies that there's dark energy.
I'm thinking of this conventionally, and I'm probably very wrong, but I've got to ask you this question anyways. If all these objects in the universe are speeding away, eventually, do they come to a wall at the end of the universe? I mean, what's there, or is it totally endless? And that I'm having a difficult time trying to comprehend.
Yeah, this depends on how honest we want to be. The honest answer is we don't know for sure what's going to happen to the universe in the very far future, or what will happen to a galaxy as it goes on forever and ever. But our simplest theory, and something we have no reason to doubt, is just that it happens forever, that galaxy moves away from us faster and faster for all of eternity. I mean, the galaxy itself would eventually evaporate away. Stars fall into black holes, and the black holes eventually evaporate. But there's no wall at the end of the universe. There's no edge. There's no rule of physics or of anything we know that says the universe has to be finite in size.
It just keeps going.
It can just keep going. That's the simplest interpretation of what we know right now.
Ah, if it can't, what does that mean?
Well, it's also possible that what we see is not all there is. So we see a universe that looks the same far away as it does here. And the easiest extrapolation is to say it just keeps looking the same forever and ever and ever. But it could be a little bit different. There could be a universe that curls in on itself on very, very large distances. So it could be like the surface of a ball that is getting bigger right now, but nevertheless has a finite size to it. And all the different possibilities are there. It could be finite in space, but infinite in time. It could last forever. It could be infinite in space, but finite in time. It could have a beginning and an end. And so we have a favorite theory, but we're very far away from saying that we're actually confident in that theory.
Could there be other balls, other bubbles connected to each other?
Absolutely. In fact, that's part of my favorite theory. That's something that a lot of people have been thinking about. And there's different ways to do it. The idea of a multiverse has many different definitions, but most cosmologists talking today, when they use the word multiverse, have exactly something like this in mind, that there's different regions of space connected to each other somehow. They're not just absolutely floating independently from each other, but where conditions are very different. Either there's a lot more density, or even the local laws of physics are very different. The particles are different. Even the number of dimensions of space can be very different. So we're trying to sort of fit together this mind-boggling set of possibilities. And ultimately, what we want to do is to ground it in a theory that says something about the world we see, so we can actually test these ideas.
What will happen, Sean, for us to get the answers that we're looking for? Will it be technology? Will it be a bigger computer? What will finally get us the answers we want?
It's going to have to be some combination of better technology and better ideas. We don't see the finish line. We don't see a path to take that I can tell you, yes, after 10 more years of work, we'll know how to reconcile gravity and quantum mechanics, whether the multiverse is real, and so forth. What we can do is make incremental changes, incremental progress, both by thinking harder and sort of trying to make sense of what we do see, but mostly by getting more data. We're really very excited about the 2010s in particle physics and cosmology, because we've been building a bunch of experiments for years now, and they're finally coming online. Gravity wave experiments, dark matter experiments, telescopes, the Large Hadron Collider in Switzerland, and all these are going to be giving us data. So we should expect surprise after surprise, and those surprises are going to help us figure out the answer.
How would you rate our growth in 100 years in terms of our growth of knowledge?
Well, the last 100 years has been absolutely amazing, and I see nothing about technology or knowledge of the human race to say that the next 100 years shouldn't be just as good. I mean, the last 100 years ago, we knew nothing about the universe on large scales. We didn't know what a galaxy was. We didn't know there were other galaxies. We didn't know how stars made their energy. We didn't know how stars glowed.
We didn't even know if there were other planets out there.
We didn't know if there were other planets. We didn't know how old the universe was, what it was made of. We didn't know that it was expanding. We didn't know about general relativity or quantum mechanics or any of those things. So, I mean, that's not to say that we're going to get the same kind of surprises and progress over the next 100 years, because we don't, in physics, we don't just throw out last century's work and start over again. We build on it. And so we think that 100 years from now, we'll still believe in curved space-time and the expanding universe and things like that, but we'll understand how they work and how they connect the large and the small much better than we do right now.
You spend a lot of time in From Eternity to Here on entropy again, that we've talked about entropy.
Yes.
Let's explain that a little bit more. Is that what the arrow of time is? Is that one and the same?
Entropy is the thing that makes the arrow of time possible. The arrow of time is simply the fact that time is not the same going forwards and going backwards. And, you know, the fundamental laws of physics, whether the ones that Newton suggested were true, or Einstein, or superstring theory these days, they all have this property that they work equally well going forwards or backwards in time. They don't distinguish between the past and the future in any important way. But the world distinguishes between the past and the future a lot. We can remember yesterday, but we can't remember tomorrow. Entropy increases, and this notion of entropy, the disorderliness of the universe, underlies all the different ways in which the past is different from the future. So it's easy to say, so entropy measures how disorderly things are. Entropy tends to increase because there's more ways to be disorderly than to be orderly. It's easier to be disorderly. Anyone who has seen a college dorm room will tell you this. And as entropy increases, that is what gives us the feeling that time passes. We remember the past, not the future, because the past had a lower entropy.
Right.
We grow old. We're not like Benjamin Button, who was born old and grew young. We all grow old in the same direction of time, and that's all because of entropy and its growth in the universe.
Why does it seem to be going faster and faster?
That's just you.
That's honest. That's
time. You know, we measure time using clocks, and as a remarkable feature of the universe in which we live, that clocks exist, which means that you have things like quartz crystals or pendulums swinging back and forth that are very predictable. You know that every time the Earth revolves around the Sun, it will also rotate around its axis 365 1/4 times. And that's predictable. It's going to be the same every time. And that relationship between different repeatable events is what makes us measure time, either using grandfather clocks or quartz watches or what have you. And so that's not speeding up or slowing down in the real world. You know, the quartz crystals in your wristwatch are not vibrating faster. But what happens is we feel time passing in our bodies, and that's because our bodies have things that repeat. They pulse back and forth. We have a heartbeat, right? We have a literal pulse.
Sure.
We breathe in and out with a certain rhythm. We have all sorts of electrochemical impulses scooting around our central nervous system. So we perceive time to pass, but our internal clocks made up of biology are not that accurate compared to quartz watches. So we feel harried and like time is passing quickly if we're on a deadline. It's passing very slowly if we're bored and so forth. That's just because you and I are not very good clocks.
In checking the entropy, ice melting is an example of that, right? In a glass?
Yes, that's right. One of the things about entropy is that two things that are at different temperatures, if you bring them together, they want to come to the same temperature.
Okay.
So an ice cube will melt, you see that all the time. Put out a glass of warm water, it will never separate into an ice cube and a glass of hot water.
How did Einstein use this as he was trying to come up with his theories?
Well, Einstein actually is very interesting. If you look at the papers he wrote as a young aspiring physicist, they were almost all about entropy and statistical mechanics and these ideas. But then he sort of hit the jackpot with relativity, and he didn't spend as much time thinking about entropy in those days. In fact, the Einstein's theories of space and time don't by themselves have much to say about entropy, and they were pretty separate subjects until in the 1970s, Stephen Hawking showed us a clue for putting them together, namely that black holes have entropy, a huge amount of entropy. And that shouldn't be a surprise because, remember, entropy likes to go up, and black holes are easy to make, and they're hard to unmake. Once the black hole is there, it's not going to go away. So you might guess that it must have a lot of entropy, and that turns out to be right.
Through entropy, through, let's say, the creation of a black hole, are they created, instantly and at will? I mean, how fast are they made?
Well, that's a good question, I'm going to give you a wishy-washy answer and say it depends. It depends on how you're making the black hole. The best way we know how to make a black hole is to have a really massive star give out its nuclear fuel and collapse and explode off its outer layers and have its inner layers collapse even further into a black hole. So there it's a matter of, you know, seconds or minutes for something like that to happen, which if you think about it, is really, really fast when you're talking about something the size of a star. I mean, the sun is enormously larger than the Earth. For something to dramatically change a star into something as small as a black hole over a course of minutes is amazing. So we would like to understand that process better. We would like to know more about the formation of black holes in the real universe. And again, that's a matter for data. That's a matter for building better telescopes, looking at things that actually happen here in our galaxy.
This dark energy and dark matter, they fascinate me. Is it possible that this could be the realm of other dimensions, or maybe these other parallel universes? Could they be within that area?
I don't think within is the right word to use, but they certainly could be related. Physicists talk about dimensions in a really quite down-to-earth, prosaic way. You sometimes hear the word dimension and you think of a different realm,
yes,
a different place. And physicists just don't mean that. You know, we have three dimensions of space in our everyday lives. We have up, down, left, right, forward, backward. And so up and down is not a place, it's a direction in which to move, right? So when physicists say extra dimensions, they literally are thinking about a different version of space-time where there'd be more directions in which you could move. And a lot of physicists think that that's the real world. There really are extra dimensions in which you can move, extra ways to make right-hand turns. But we can't see them because the actual physical size of the universe along these directions is microscopically tiny. It's just curled up into a little tiny ball, so we can't see it without a really, really good microscope. So there could be another world right next to ours in that extra dimension. We could have a parallel brain, as physicists call it. Brain is just a shorter version of the word membrane. So if we imagine that our whole world is a three-dimensional surface in a higher dimensional space, then there could be other surfaces right next to ours. And now we're getting into things that modern physicists love to talk about, but we can't quite make concrete yet. We'd love to connect that to dark matter, dark energy, and so forth. We have all these ideas, these sort of theoretical playthings to work with. But right now, the connections are pretty tenuous. We don't really know how that works.
For you, Sean, what answer to a question would you like answered that you just haven't had yet?
Well, my basic question is, again, why is the past different from the future? But that turns into a very specific question: why was the Big Bang unusual in the way that it was? And I think that not only do we not know the answer to this question, I think that modern cosmologists tend to ignore it. They underappreciate the importance of this. We've been fooling ourselves a little bit about how hard it's going to be to really understand why the Big Bang looks the way it did.
And what was the Big Bang? Because I think of something that exploded.
Yeah, it's hard to conceptualize because, you know, we live our lives in a very tiny region of space-time, okay? We live for 100 years. We walk around thousands of miles. But the universe is 14 billion years old and tens of billions of light years across. So we only get a little piece of it. And if you think about how the universe works in larger scale, there's no place in the universe where the Big Bang happened. The Big Bang is not a point in space. It's a moment in time. The Big Bang is the moment when everything in the universe was on top of everything else, when there was infinite density. And what happened there, we don't know. We can talk with extreme accuracy about what the universe was doing 1 second after the Big Bang. We would like to push that back to 1/10,000th of a second after the Big Bang. But 0 seconds after the Big Bang, we're still just guessing about right now.
If there are parallel universes, did they all start at the same time? Or, you know, could we have started, as they say, 14 billion years ago? Could another one have started 50 billion years ago?
Yeah, both of those are very, very possible. It's completely possible that different parts of the universe, different pockets within the multiverse, started completely different times. And in fact, I mean, forget about 50 billion years ago. Think about a Google years ago, 10 to the 100 years ago.
Yeah.
Or in part of my own theory that I'm thinking about these days, some of these universes started in the past with arrows of time that point in the opposite direction. They're, you know, compared to us, they're flowing backwards in time, these universes. It's not something we will ever be able to see or perceive or directly probe. But if you have a theory that explains what you do see, and that theory also predicts these wild consequences, then you sort of have to swallow the consequences.
Sean, what got you interested in theoretical physics?
Who knows? I think it was reading books. I was 10 years old, honestly, when I first started annoying my elementary school teachers by telling them that I wanted to grow up to be a theoretical physicist.
You even knew the phrase then?
Well, oh yeah, I was very proud of that.
Yeah.
Are you kidding me? I was thrilled to know that phrase, and I let everyone know about it. I didn't really know what it meant to be a theoretical physicist. I didn't know what they did on a day-to-day basis, but I was reading about the Big Bang and black holes and quarks and leptons, and I thought that was the coolest stuff in the world.
Well, that's fantastic. And the book, From Eternity to Here, is it available right now for folks?
It is. It came out last week, so I'm hoping that people get excited by it.
You know, I am so fascinated by your work and just the mysteries that are out there in the universe. I mean, it is truly endless, isn't it, these possibilities?
Well, it is, and I think it's a great privilege to be one of the very, very few people in our society and in the world that sort of gets to think about these things as their job. And you know, I don't at all take it for granted. I realize that we've been curious about the universe since civilization began. Every human being, when they're young, is curious about these things, and then they get it beaten out of them by school and pressures and mortgages and things like that. But the interest is still there. The curiosity is still there, and we're learning an amazing amount.
Well, when we come back, we'll talk more about From Eternity to Here and also just some various aspects of what is out there and how are parallel universes formed and what could be happening. I mean, are there earthbound planets out there? Who knows? Our special guest tonight, Sean Carroll, and we'll be back with him in a moment on Coast to Coast AM.